University of Colorado.
Without a doubt, it's been a rough year. As we welcome 2021, See You on the Air looks back on 2020 to highlight our top five shows. Not surprisingly, three of the five most popular podcasts were COVID-19 related. The other two were about See You in Space and the importance of diversity, equity, and inclusion. As we navigate the coronavirus, there's a great need for frank discussions about psychiatric disorders as the weeks and months roll on. In August, we spoke with Dr. Neil Epperson from the CU School of Medicine about her podcast, Mind the Brain, which explores the many aspects of mental health during the COVID-19 pandemic. Addressing topics ranging from the ongoing uncertainty to parental and teen stress, cancer care during a pandemic, and the tendency to drink too much alcohol, Mind the Brain comes in at number five.
To be able to speak about the kind of stress that we're experiencing, this kind of unprecedented stress that keeps going and going and going. We have no idea when it ends. A lot of people are feeling really out of control. And again, this kind of social isolation. And usually as human beings, we manage our stress a lot of times by social interaction. And so I just knew early on in the pandemic that this was going to be a tough one for us as human beings, and that there were going to be many, many people that weren't going to be able to manage their stress in the same way that they had before, and that social contact was not going to be one of the ways that people could cope with some of the things that they're dealing with. I think if people have a better understanding of the underlying causes and why this situation, this unprecedented, uncontrollable, or seemingly uncontrollable stress that we're experiencing is just like a perfect storm for creating an increased risk for mental health issues.
What are some of the particular issues that are driven by this pandemic or magnified by the pandemic?
When we realized that was going to happen, we went into overdrive because, I mean, I've studied human behavior long enough to know that social connectedness, you know, it's hormonally driven. We get a little shot of oxytocin when we have wonderful, close, intimate relationships with people that we care about. And there is a relationship between stress and oxytocin, for example. So when one is stressed, you get a shot of cortisol, that kind of stress hormone, but you also get a little shot of oxytocin. It's kind of like the nature's way of saying, hey, you do need to be stressed about this, but we don't want you to be overly stressed. And so I think it's something
where do I get some of that?
Where do you get some of that? I know. I'm starting to think of maybe we should do a clinical trial with some oxytocin. But the bottom line is that we knew that as mental health care providers, and I've studied hormone effects on the brain my entire career, and I recognized that this was going to be a major challenge.
Exploring the moon and even possibly colonizing it sounds pretty good these days to us Earthlings. Our number four podcast features CU Boulder astrophysical and planetary sciences professor Jack Burns, who has long-standing ties with NASA. In fact, since the late 1940s, CU Boulder has sent experiments and instruments to every planet in our solar system. In 50-plus space missions, NASA spacecraft have launched hundreds of instruments from CU, as well as 20 CU scientists, faculty, and alumni.
Well, the SpaceX launch really is, it's paradigm breaking in many ways, because up till this point, all of the major launches, all of the both large and small launches, really have been done by government-led space agencies in the US, the European Space Agency, India, and so forth. So now we're in an era of these new so-called public-private partnerships, in which, starting a few years ago, individual companies have been launching resupply missions to the International Space Station. These are uncrewed, but they provide supplies. Now, for the first time, we have astronauts being launched by a private company. And what NASA was doing is, unlike in the old days, where NASA was controlling the launch. They bought the rocket. They were in charge of it. In this case, NASA is buying services. And the service is to launch NASA astronauts to space. 50 years ago, it took the resources of the greatest country, the richest country in the world, the United States, to just be able to do these launches. Now private companies can do it. And so that frees up NASA to do the really hard things in space, to set up bases on the moon or eventually go to Mars. It's just the whole idea that we're working now for getting to the moon. I like to call this forward to the moon, not going back to the moon. Rather than going to the same places that Apollo landed, we're going to go to places like the far side of the moon to put down low radio frequency telescopes. We're going to go to the poles of the moon where there's water. You can mine that water, convert it into rocket fuel, and not have to bring all of that fuel from the Earth. And very importantly, it's only 3 days away.
University of Colorado was part of a consortium that worked pretty hard to get the U.S. Space Command headquartered in Colorado Springs. And of course, 6 years is still a temporary, but what's the significance of that announcement?
Well, there too, it just further solidifies that Colorado is really the center of space in so many ways, not just for space science, like what we do at Boulder, but also for space defense. The Space Command being here means that much of the advanced technologies, development of new satellites, new software, using things like artificial intelligence are being developed right here in Colorado.
CU Colorado Springs professor Chip Benight shows true grit on a global scale and in popularity as our number three podcast this year. Benight researches human adaptation from trauma, including recovery from natural disasters such as the coronavirus pandemic, as well as man-made disasters, accident, trauma, violence, bereavement, and more. In COVID's wake, he started the Greater Resilience Information Toolkit, or GRIT, that is accessible to people overwhelmed by the pandemic, from frontline workers to caregivers to your next door neighbor.
When an event like this happens, what happens to people in general is that they're having to adapt and change in ways they never thought they would. And so when that goes on, some people, for example, may experience a lot of sleep disruption. They may have feelings of anxiety. They may feel really threatened, especially if you're in a high-risk group, such as older adults or medical professionals. And that can bring up a lot of challenges for people where they feel kind of knocked down, if you will. And resilience is really that capacity to get back up, to regain that sense of, I can do this, I can manage this. And what we're really interested in that is, what are the factors that really help people to do that rebound, to get them so that they can stand back up? And so the skills are really broad-based. They're basic listening skills, number one. We need to help people to understand how to reach out to somebody, how to respond sort of empathically. And then also we're training them on specific ways to boost their sense of power and control over what's going on for them. Because what happens for a lot of people is they end up targeting and focusing on things they can't control. They focus on the bad news that's coming out of all the different news networks. They focus on what they can't go out and do like they used to do. And so what we do is really help them to retarget what they do have control over and motivate them to focus on those things, such as eating well, sleeping, taking care of themselves physically, being connected to their loved ones, things like that.
We hear a lot that humans are a resilient species. Obviously, there's those at one end of the spectrum who are quite resilient and others at the other end who really struggle with things. But where would you say most people are? Are people resilient?
Absolutely. There's some great work by George Bonanno out of Columbia from several years back that showed that the bulk of the population is quite resilient. They recover well following a major event such as a natural disaster or bereavement or things like that. So we really see somewhere between 60 to 70% of the population does well. And part of what we're thinking about with this is that overall, people will tend to do fine over time. What we want to do is help to boost that capacity early on, rather than, you know, waiting and hoping that people sort of generally get better.
University of Colorado has remarkable researchers who are on the leading edge of exploration and change, whether through environmental or business studies, or through healthcare advances in space exploration. CU's impact reaches throughout Colorado, far into the solar system. Do you know of an exceptional faculty member who you'd suggest for CU On the Air? Email us at ontheair@cu.edu. That's ontheair@cu.edu. About 300,000 people in the U.S. and some 3,500 Coloradans have died of COVID-19 as of this date, but good news is on the horizon. Recently, Moderna Therapeutics announced that its analysis found its coronavirus vaccine to be 94.5% effective. In November 2020, CU On the Air spoke with Dr. Thomas Campbell, professor of medicine and infectious disease and leader of the Moderna vaccine trials at the CU Anschutz Medical Campus. This episode is our number 2 most popular podcast of 2020.
When we conduct clinical trials, as we've done with Moderna and Pfizer, clinical trials measure efficacy. And so clinical trials are very controlled experiments. They're scientific experiments. In those experiments, we can very precisely determine vaccine efficacy. Effectiveness is the term that's used to apply to how well vaccines are working in the community. So we won't know the effectiveness of these vaccines until after their use is widespread in the community. And then our public health system can then determine across our population how well they're working.
We know that the CU Anschutz Medical Campus is one of the leading academic medical centers in the country, but how did you and the campus get involved in this clinical trial?
We were asked to join an effort funded through the National Institutes of Health called the COVID Prevention Network. And this network consists of existing NIH-sponsored clinical research sites that have conducted various types of clinical trials in the past. In our case, our experience has largely been in clinical trials in HIV. And we've conducted clinical trials in HIV treatment, HIV prevention, and HIV vaccines in the past. Because of our experience in HIV, we were invited to join the COVID Prevention Network. And we're very fortunate to be part of that. And I should add that the Anschutz campus is remarkable in that we actually have 2 COVID Prevention Network sites. My site is anchored in the Division of Infectious Diseases in the Department of Medicine. And there is also a site that is anchored in the section of infectious diseases in the Department of Pediatrics. And then you may have also heard about Operation Warp Speed. And the Anschutz campus has also received significant support through Operation Warp Speed. We've received a mobile and temporary facilities that enable us to see patients both for prevention of COVID as well as for treatment of COVID.
So how precisely does this vaccine work?
So this vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, as well as the Pfizer vaccine, are RNA-based technology. So what that means is this, is that the sort of the tried and true, the way that we've made vaccines for many years, if not hundreds of years, is to grow the virus up in the laboratory, kill the virus, and then inject the dead virus into our shoulder muscle. So for instance, that's the way most influenza vaccines are made. That's a tedious process. It takes a long time to grow up large quantities of virus. So this new technology that's messenger RNA based gets around all of those difficulties with either whole virus preparations or with single protein preparations. And what the vaccine actually consists of is a messenger RNA molecule. So messenger RNA or messenger ribonucleic acid is the substance in our cells that contains the information that tells our cells how to make proteins. So our body consists of thousands of different proteins, and each of those proteins is made by our cells using the instructions in a unique messenger RNA molecule. So for these vaccines, what Moderna and Pfizer have done is to create a messenger RNA molecule that has the instructions for making a coronavirus protein. And this coronavirus protein is called the spike protein. It's the big protein on the surface of the virus. It's the first thing that the body's immune system sees. And so what the way the vaccine works then is that messenger RNA that has all the information to tell our cells how to make the spike protein, that's what's injected into our shoulder muscle. And then our cells take up that messenger RNA, they start reading those instructions, and they start making the spike protein. Our body's immune system sees that spike protein and recognizes it as something foreign and develops an antibody immune response targeted against it. You know, both of these trials, so Pfizer and Moderna, we could consider those to be independent scientific experiments. So conducted independently by two different companies, both with very similar vaccine products, have now come to the exact same result. Both 94-95% efficacy in preventing COVID-19 illness. So that, you know, the fact that two independent experiments came to that conclusion is truly remarkable and really speaks to the faith that we can have in these findings.
Civil unrest has been a monumental theme for 2020, drawing attention to the critical need for diversity, equity, and inclusion at CU and across the country. The CU On The Air team is proud that this podcast recorded in June was by far our most popular. In African Americans, Allies Confront Racism and Health Disparities, CU Chief Diversity Officer Theodosia Cook discusses police brutality against people of color, the protesters who took to the streets across the U.S. calling for change, and the needs of African Americans who continue to die of COVID-19 in disproportionate numbers.
What are some of the issues that you're anticipating working on in the coming year?
Really broadly, it's race in America is going to be a huge one, as we can see right now at the national level, right? People are advocating for equity for Black people, which requires us to change some policies, practices, and norms to provide the Black community what they need and what they've been promised, the life of liberty and the pursuit of happiness.
As of late May, it's reported nearly 23% of COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. were African Americans, even though they only make up 13% of the U.S. population. Why do you think that is, and what can be done about it?
This is where I'm going to share with you all to really look at the recent April 2020 McKinsey report on Black lives during COVID-19. You know, the report does a great job of showing that Black Americans, although yes, there are worse health outcomes, it is not just because they are Black, it's because of the systemic issues surrounding under-resourced communities, poor environments for investment, lower rates of career advancement, and overrepresentation in lower wage jobs that really have impacted this community disproportionately. And so when we think about that, you know, 39% of jobs held by Black workers, about 7 million, are vulnerable to reductions in hours of pay, temporary furloughs, or permanent layoffs. And looking at the prison population that has also been impacted, 33% of those in prison are Black. But like you said, only 13% of the U.S. population is. I, as a child, although I was born in South America, I grew up part of my life in Brooklyn and Queens. And the epidemic there is so harsh towards Black people, Black immigrants in New York. And that has a lot to do with the lack of healthcare that's accessible towards them, the food deserts that exist that don't allow for people to eat healthy foods, which then impacts their diet, which then creates these underlying health conditions. If we really kind of date this back, I would be wrong not to state that my other peers in diversity and inclusion would say this is a root cause of the reality of when Black people in America were freed from slavery. Although they were promised land and economic opportunity, it was never given to them. And it has continued to place Black Americans at a disproportionate advantage when it comes to health, education, and social mobility in this country.
Do you think the kind of protests that we're seeing now bring about the kind of change that we seek and that we need?
Absolutely. From our history of the Boston Tea Party and the way protests have created and allowed us to create this democracy, the United States of America, that we have currently, to the protests we saw during the Civil Rights Movement that allowed civil rights law to come into place, protests in our country have always brought about change and change in creating a more inclusive environment for all of our countrymen, our country people. And so, yes, I do think this will bring about change. We are already seeing that right now. And Martin Luther King's thoughts at the end of his life was very clear. He was concerned that he brought his people, and when I say his people, I mean the African American, the Black community in America, into a burning house. And that burning house was symbolized America. And the reason why he said that was because he was concerned that this home wouldn't be a home to them. And similar to the bombings that he encountered in his own home with his family, he was concerned that Black people would never truly be accepted, even by those who were moderate, because it would require us to really evaluate the privileges we have and the things we own, and really identify a way to redistribute the privilege and the wealth in this country to really create an equitable environment for those who were enslaved for hundreds of years in this country.
The University of Colorado comprises four campuses: Boulder, Colorado Springs, Denver, and the CU Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora. To learn more about CU, go to www.cu.edu. Thanks to our producer, Kathy Buten, and audio engineer, John Arnold. I'm Ken McConnellog, and we'll see you on the air next month.
University of Colorado.